this panel is going to be a banger. We got Jonathan Kirkwood from 1031, Cassie Clifton from Galaxy, Harry Sudock from Grid, and then Matt's going to moderate this. So give these guys a round of applause, please.
We're going to do 30 minutes. We're going to have fun with it. I'm very excited about this panel. I think we got a great group of people up here. So 2022. Well, first of all, I don't know if anyone looked at the price, but we're over 18K, so we're rich again. So we're going to act a little bit. 2022. Is that for real? That's what I said.
Tell me,
2022 was absolutely brutal for miners. And I think it's hard to talk about what's next for mining in 2023 unless we first start with what went wrong in 2022. And I know Marty said he didn't want to pick on CoreSci, but we should just pick on CoreSci. They were absolutely massive. They were crushing it, right? They were the darling. Everyone wanted to be them, or a lot of people wanted to be them. And now they're on the midst of bankruptcy.
They filed.
Yeah. Why did that happen? And can that be avoided, or is that just something that happens every cycle, no matter what? And we will start with Harry, because he's very excited.
Never not excited. I think in order to talk about kind of what went wrong in 2022, we need to talk about what happened in 2022. And in the context of mining, you know, to me, that really means sort of three key things. The first is that global hash rate exploded, and it exploded on top of the MINA chining ban. So China said, get the ASICs out of here. We're shutting down this sector. This is not part of our economy anymore. We saw global hash rate get cut in half. And all of us with hash rate active were saying, this is incredible. Our margins are expanding. I love every minute of this. It's going to take forever to recover to previous levels, even though price was still ripping. And we were wrong. So instead of it taking a long time, it took a very short period of time. All of that hash rate got either moved to the US or existing operations that were under development in the US hit their expansion numbers, and global hash rate ripped past the previous sort of China included all-time high and continued to go further. And that happened when Bitcoin price was on its way up at the beginning or end of 21 into beginning of 22, and it just continued no matter how far price bled. So the competition for those 900 Bitcoin a day was unbelievably intense. The second thing that happened was we saw Bitmain and MicroBT deliver machine volumes at higher efficiencies at massive scale. So the way that that hash rate climbed was that everybody who put in those pre-orders in 2021 for hundreds of thousands, tens of exahash of units got delivered. The machines were high quality in the S19J Pro series, in the M30S Plus and S++ series. All those machines hit their numbers. There was no S17, you know, hardware failure debacle. So the quality of the hardware that got delivered was really high. And then what's the third thing that happened is that the financing structures that the private and public companies entered into to buy all of those machines blew up in everybody's face. So you've got compressed margins from hash rate rising. You've got machines all getting delivered en masse. And then you've got all the financing structures that paid for those machines going totally south and punishing all of the miners who now can't service that debt, whose collateral is now worth far less because Bitcoin price down, miner price down. And so we get to the end of this year and everybody is sort of on the battlefield, either bleeding or dead. Now we're now.
Do you want to add about, you know, Core Scientific started, like their business plan and the fact that they pivoted to, initially they were providing hosting and then they pivoted, they took the cheap liquidity that was in the market and started mining on their own, which they failed miserably at.
Yeah. So why did Core struggle? Number one is that like they, you know, they were incredibly large and successful and continue to be, right? Just because they've filed for bankruptcy doesn't mean those assets disappeared, right? An airline files for bankruptcy, the plane still sits on the tarmac. And so, you know, so those facilities and those assets still exist. So it's important to kind of acknowledge that along the way. But like, why did they struggle? Is because they had a lot of debt that they had to service. Their margins got significantly compressed because we talked about hash rate going up, but also, you know, the nature of their powers appears, you know, I don't have any information about it, but what it seems like in all the court documents is that they had variable rate power. And, you know, apparently there was a war in Eastern Europe that tripled the price of natural gas for all of us. And so you're seeing margin compression on the revenue side on the exahash, but you're also seeing your cost of goods sold triple or quadruple because the price of gas went from $1 in MCS to $5.
I think the other thing that has been touched on more indirectly and just like more directly hit on this is that the assumption that everyone was operating on is that number continues to go up. So people took out these massive amounts of financing at basically the all-time peak to buy machines at the all-time high. So now they're literally purchasing at the very top and they're stuck holding these bags and they can't afford it. And they're also assuming like they had these hash rate assumptions that Harry had mentioned. And they're assuming that price is at least going to stay where it is or continue to go up. Like no one was expecting the levels that we're at today. And so they weren't building risk tolerant models to like expect for this type of downturn. And so now they're completely underwater on the liabilities that they have outstanding and the power costs that are rising. So they're just being squeezed on all sides. It's a macro backdrop. It's energy prices rising and it's Bitcoin price. So all of these things kind of just blending together to this perfect storm.
I just want to give one number, which I think is really relevant because like we see Bitcoin at today it's 18,000 and like that doesn't feel low. Because it isn't. Historically, this is a great price for Bitcoin. But to understand sort of the mining economics, we are at all-time lows. We're low, like we're making less money on a terahash day basis right now than we would have when Bitcoin went to 3,200 or when, you know, Bitcoin dropped to 1,000 during a previous epoch. So to understand sort of the nature of like where you see Bitcoin price on the chart versus where you see mining economics on the chart, we are at all-time lows, even though Bitcoin is like still reasonably high.
Yeah. And when we mentioned cheap liquidity, these miners, large-scale miners, were taking out loans at 15 to 18% interest rates when, you know, Bitcoin was at 40 to 60,000. But at this rate, they are, you know, unable to service those loans. And so that's when she's talking about the liabilities are underwater.
Is the bloodbath over yet?
In mining?
Is the global bloodbath over yet? Like,
it's tricky, right? So, like, I think that energy prices, like, I think the top is in. I think we're going to get cheaper power from here, and so that's really good, if I'm right. I think that, you know, is the bottom in for Bitcoin? No idea. Is the top in for hash rate? I think that we're getting pretty close to the marginal levels.
I guess to reframe my question. Obviously, every miner is in a different situation. This cycle, all the cycles in Bitcoin, if you stay around long enough, they tend to blur together. There's a lot of similarities, but there's also major differences that have this time is different, right? There's major differences every cycle. This cycle, the major difference I saw was massive ASIC collateralized loans, usually by public traded companies or at least very large companies that were able to access this cheap external capital, right? Finance it and really expand their operations significantly. Is the bloodbath over? And I know I'm saying this to two people that work with large mining operations. Is the bloodbath over for those large mining firms, or is that still a story that's being told? Like when we look back, like, are we mid-chapter in the history book, or is it towards the end?
I don't think we're at the end. I think we're towards the end. I think that, like, 2023 is really going to be a year of survival. Like, no one really has an idea. Like, I don't have a magic ball to tell you what the price is going to be. And unfortunately, like, we're all just kind of, like, victims of the price until it goes up. And so at the end of the day, like, it's going to be a struggle to survive. And there are a lot of miners that will need an influx of cash in order to survive. And capital markets are effectively closed unless you have friends and family and really, really great relationships in that arena. So it's going to be really tough for a lot of people out there. There are a lot of people that are like struggling to keep their heads above water and are doing it really gracefully, honestly. And I'm impressed with some of them. But at the same time, like, I don't think it's quite over, but I think most of the shakeout is here. I will say I think there will be additional supply of ASICs coming onto the market. not just from like the Celsiuses of the world, but it's like they're still manufacturing a shit ton of these machines, like over 100,000 manufactured a month. And so it's just like, what does that do to the market? So we'll continue to see like all-time low ASIC pricing, which will be good for growth in a lot of companies that are well-positioned.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Do we think this idea, if you ask most people in 2021 and early 2022, they would say the majority of hash rate will be dominated by large firms, large mining firms, that hash rate will centralize. The firms that have access to cheap capital will be able to dominate. Most people did not think that the Fed would raise so hard so quickly. Most people did not think capital markets would seize up so quickly. I remember Marty in January 2022, he made the cardinal sin on the podcast. He spoke in absolutes and he said, there is no way the Fed will raise rates. And I was caught off guard too, but I just didn't use the absolute. Is that still what do you guys think? Do you guys think that the majority of hash will be dominated by large firms, or do we expect kind of a distribution of hash out of, what did Rob say? Chicken shack operations, right?
I like that term. Want to give everyone else a chance to answer. I mean, my high level thesis is yes. That's largely because you want the lowest cost power. In order to have low cost power, you need money. In order to have money, you probably need to have some sort of like large asset situation on your balance sheet. So I just don't, you're not going to get a PPA at a low price, or you're not going to be able to co-locate with a solar miner unless you are deemed as credit worthy and have a large operation.
I'll take the other side. I think over the next kind of short-term future of, let's say, 2 to 4 years, that there's going to be a larger push for going after pro-regulatory locales where you've had declining population or deindustrialization. And you can put a 5 to 25 megawatt site instead of a gigawatt site in some locations. And what you're doing is you're providing a benefit to the community, and that's why it's pro-regulatory, because they need someone to come in and buy the power so that the average citizen isn't footing the bill. So their price, their cost per kilowatt isn't going up for their electricity bill. And I think over, let's say, this decade, the overall cost for power, I think, will trend up. I think we're probably trending down right now, but I believe we're probably in cheap peak energy right now, at least until we start doing more nuclear. But for, like I said, two to four years, we will be probably focusing more on 5 to 25 megawatt and the locations that are needed for humanity to continue to thrive. And then after that, I think that the sats from mining will be a byproduct, or will be just one of the revenue streams from the heat that's generated from the mining. And that, as efficiencies are driven forward, it's going to be who can acquire as much use out of that kilowatt that is being purchased from either the grid or being manufactured from a well site. How much use and utility for humanity can be obtained? And so is that heat that is being pumped to the small towns or the cities, is it is that heat then being recycled to mine more, or is it being used for some other use case for humanity?
I'm going to have it both ways and say just that the era of sort of unconstrained ability to stand up mining operations is over. The need for structural advantages has now begun. So if what you used to be able to do is, buy some piece of hardware and plug it in your garage, and you're probably not super profitable, but you're reasonably cash flow positive, and you can kind of justify it. And, as long as your Excel model straight lines Bitcoin price and straight lines hash rate, it'll be fine. You'll pay back in 18, 20 months. And then that doesn't happen. So, the sort of the low barrier to entry mining opportunities, those are going to be where the struggle will continue. But if you're able to have differentiated access to power, whether it's through large scale credit worthiness or positive externalities in a community, and there's also a bunch of other ways that you can unlock these types of true structural cost advantages on how you power your ASICs, like that's what's required to move forward at this point. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot of people do interesting stuff, and whether that's, you know, some of the you know, off-grid hydro in other countries, like that's exciting and interesting. And I don't know whether or not that's going to work at scale, but I do know that they're generating kilowatt hours in a differentiated way, and that's now become table stakes.
You have something to add, Cassie?
No, I was just going to make a comment. It's fine.
That's the point.
I saw the mic raise, so I was being...
I don't remember. It's fine.
So where do we think the greatest opportunities lie then for miners right now?
I mean, I think like the screamingly obvious one is that the cost per terahash is way, 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 way lower, right? So imagine that you get to buy Bitcoin, you know, at these much lower levels. Like it's just easier to be in a strong financial position when you're capitalizing your site at $5 to $15 a terahash, not $50 to $150, which is basically what happened over the last, you know, the previous 18 months.
You know, the kind of the question that I have, and you know, as an investor in companies that are building out these infrastructure, is yes, you can enter at these lower price points today than what you were 2 years ago. But you know, if you're wanting to make sure that you're building a sustainable business that's going to last not just 2 years, but you know, maybe 1 to 2 epochs, you know, is there going to be enough sats from the mining that is going to be able to subsidize or to facilitate the site? I really think that there needs to be a really leaning into what you determined the externalities of mining and all of the benefits that will provide to the local population. Otherwise, I don't think that in 6 years that there's going to be enough mining reward or subsidy and reward to economically sustain a, you know, 100 megawatt, 500 megawatt site.
Why so bearish?
So you're basically speaking towards like these massive brand new warehouse sites that are being built all over the place.
Correct.
Even some of like our internal models, super low cost power, like locked in at a fixed rate, like you're looking at potentially having to curtail like 70% of the time, just depending on like where hash rate is. Curtail 30% of the time. So you're looking at like 70% uptime. You have to be a lot more strategic. You need to have like other ways that you're diversifying your revenue. And like, at the end of the day, what you really need to do is to understand the market that you operate in, and you need to understand like the power market that you're operating in. And so you need to get a lot smarter on that front to be able to survive in the future.
I'm kind of curious. I'm just going to switch it up a little bit. I'm curious what you guys think. ASIC collateralized loans. Are they going to be massive next cycle as well? Is there going to be changes to how they're structured? Was this a one cycle phenomenon?
Yeah. So this is like, for context and like full disclosure, the primary like role that I'm in is effectively like managing MiFi for miners. So like people come to me and ask for loans, and I have these initial conversations and like walk them through diligence and get a feel for whether or not they qualify. Brandon and I in the audience here, also at Galaxy, we've been working on a project recently that's effectively like revamping ASIC-backed loans as we know them. The traditional model that we've seen doesn't work. There's a lot of reasons it doesn't work. The primary reason being that like we built a fixed interest rate, like short-term loan effectively, like over 12 to 18 months, and offered that in the most volatile asset class in the world. You know, there's no PIC interest that we're offering. There's no cash flow sweeps. There's no real way to de-risk. And so what ended up happening at Galaxy, at least, is we ended up turning down 97% of the people that came knocking on our door asking for money. Our loans have performed. You know, it certainly hasn't been like a pleasant experience for us. And the diligence is insane. Like there's a massive diligence undertaking. But yeah, I would say they will look very different. We'll be thinking about things like not just converts, but potentially forced converts if we're looking at doing them. We'll be looking at things like cash flow sweeps, like PIK interest. We'll be looking at like min and max paybacks periods versus just flat rate term loans, because if Bitcoin price, you know, goes up, like we want to de-risk, we want to cash flow sweep and like not just sit there collecting like our meager little income while they're making like raking in money and then doing who knows what with it. It's going to have debt, you know, there's going to be a ton of different like covenants on leverage and debt to equity. So there's going to be a lot of things that we're going to use to help de-risk these loans in the future.
I'm going to do what every miner does when things go badly, blame the manufacturers. And I mean that seriously. Like the reason that the ASIC backed loans, oh, keep laughing. The reason that these loans went so upside down is because the manufacturers felt comfortable pricing the machines in future Bitcoin revenue terms. And that's crazy, right? So like the cost to produce the hardware is what it is. But the price that they were selling the hardware at and that the market was tolerating at the time, to be clear, they weren't, you know, they weren't forcing miners to do things they didn't want to do. The market priced it. You know, they were basically saying, here's what the next 200 to 400 days of revenue look like. This is the cost of the machine.
But isn't that what always happens? That's always been the case.
Thus far. But this, if I were to be the ASIC-backed loan czar, and waving my magic czar wand on top of the lending markets, I would say that I'm willing to lend into a fixed price environment for the hardware, whether Bitcoin's trading at 10,000, 20,000,
or 50,000. So you don't value it at the market price or whatever.
You can only collateralize the machine at sort of the minimum clearing price.
Liquidation value.
Exactly. I think that has to do more with the, I think we can probably agree that the last 3 years is probably an exaggeration of liquidity from, let's say, the Fed, the entire stimuluses that have occurred, and kind of the easygoing mentality of the last like 12-year bull market of just equities and everything. So
50-year bull market.
I mean, I think, you know, let's set that aside, but also the question of, you know, will you have ASIC-backed loans? I mean, it's going to be a commodity, and all commodities, like the production of commodities, they get loans. You get to produce oil, gold, agricultural goods. So yes, there will be continued lending for ASIC-backed loans, but there's not going to be the same, or I would not think there's going to be the same exaggeration in the amount of liquidity that's being pumped into the system, because I mean, it's still a buyer and a seller meeting and making a price.
I'm just thinking about how to price the collateral, right? So if I'm like, at the end of the day, like, why do I think about an ASIC-backed loan as a financial instrument? It's because I post a certain amount of collateral in exchange for cash to purchase, you know, something. Or run the business. And so like, how do I value that collateral is no longer going to be, you know, whatever, 60% of the current ASIC price, which was basically what was done historically. It's going to be, this is sort of my lower bound on the risk model, and the risk model is going to have a much lower bound. And that's the amount that I'm willing to finance against this piece of collateral. The same way that if you go to Unchained and say, I want a Bitcoin-backed loan, right? There's this concept of LTV, which is if I give you one Bitcoin, I'm going to get some percentage less than that current day's value in cash back for it. I just think that we're going to see the same mechanics. We're just going to see them in sort of a more conservative iteration.
I agree with that. And I think like to kind of prove this point and to offer like some more concrete numbers here, like we only really look at liquidation value when we're thinking about how to price the underlying asset that we're underwriting and that we're offering a loan against. And so like, for example, if I say today I'm looking at new machines on the market and they're priced at $10 a terahash, I think, you know, and we're using like reasonable data that we have knowing like, okay, let's say 200,000 Celsius machines are coming onto the market pending few weeks, right? So I think that an actual liquidation value for a theoretical, I don't know, 20,000 ASICs we might be underwriting is actually $5 a T. That's where I feel 100% confidence that I can get all of my money back. And so that's the liquidation value that we're offering. That's separate from the LTV. So down from there, let's say I might offer a 50% LTV. So now I'm giving you $250 on your $10 a terahash machine that you paid that you paid for, or that it's maybe you didn't pay for, and maybe that's the value that it is today. Yeah. So that's how we're thinking about that. Additionally, we'll probably also have margin call provisions in there, which is really unfortunate. But at the end of the day, like if you don't have additional ASICs to post, we're going to be repoing your machines.
And that's the conservative outcome that happens when you blow out hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars of cash across 10 to 15 different companies that are upside down.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to go with next cycle, people are going to do crazy, insane shit and just lose their shirts.
We are lowercase right. You are capital R right.
There's going to be like nothing conservative about next.
Crazier.
Yeah. Yeah, it always gets crazier. You always can bet on crazier. But before we hit Q&A, I'm curious, home mining, bullish or bearish, why? Harry?
Bullish on it happening, bearish on unit economics.
Okay. Cassie?
I live in Puerto Rico, so I have island energy prices, so I'm a little bit bearish on home mining, but...
I am bullish on home mining and locales where they're going to be able to harvest their heat. I mean, we were seeing... the latest with crypto cloaks. You can get a black box from Steve Barber and then pump in that heat from distributed hat. Oh, you're showing from the crypto cloaks.
That's the 3D printed shroud they have there. So you can pump it into your heating system.
Correct. I think these externalities are going to be what is, you know, really exciting for individuals to be able to go after to lower their all-in cost for heating their homes. Living their lives.
I like that answer. I like Jonathan's answer the most. What percent? Yeah. Before we get to Q&A, what in how many years are we doing? 50 years. In 50 years.
What's all done?
Okay. We won't do 50, and we won't. In 30 years, what percentage of world energy production will be used by Bitcoin mining? We'll start with Harry.
14.5%.
14.5%. Cassie? Just
take my dart and throw it at a board. I think less than 10.
Less than 10.
That also assumes like continued population growth and like we now electrify like, you know, the other 40% of the world, 60% of the world.
Fair. Jonathan?
I think long term it's going to be less than 5, probably less than, you know, could be down to less than 1, because we're going to need a tremendous amount of coordination to be an interplanetary species, and fully anticipate that this century.
You can always count on Jonathan.
Most base answer.
Jonathan was just hiding his bearishness behind like bullish on humanity. Thank you guys. Let's thank our panelists.
Thank your moderator.
Thank you, Faith.